Hello and welcome to Reclaiming My Theology, a podcast seeking to take our theology back from ideas and systems that oppress. I am your host, Brandy Miller. Today, I'm joined by E. Cole to talk about consent. See, y'all, this is a conversation I've wanted to have and offer to the Reclaiming community for a while. This extended series on purity culture is offering spaces to not only deconstruct what we've been previously holding, but to rebuild ethics and values that build the relationships and character that we really want, not just in an intimate or sexual space, but also in the church, in our families, in our friendships, and in the world. This conversation is a core foundation of that work. In this conversation, because we are talking about consent and how to build it, we also mention rape culture, and use strong language because y'all know I don't usually get through one of these without cussing. So, with all of those caveats, please enjoy this conversation with my friend E. I'm really grateful to have you on today to have some space to have this conversation, even if this conversation is one that I think I would rather not have to have at any point, because I just wish that the world was such that that wouldn't be the case. But I'm so grateful. So thank you so much for your time today.
I'm so glad to be here. Thanks for having me back on the pod.
Yes, back again.
Back again.
I love a repeat guest.
So honored.
Not a lot of people I trust to do that. So it just feels like a lovely opportunity. But for folks who don't know you, since you were on right in that first year of the podcast and a lot about your life has changed since then, I would love for you to describe for folks who don't know or don't know you or who don't know you in this season, E, what does it mean to be
Beautiful.
You?
Thank you. Yeah, there have been a lot of shifts since the last time I was on, namely my name. So I go by E. I would say it's a preferred name. Many people know me as Erin Corey Cole. And I have been coming out as trans non-binary over the last really year in a series of shifts since I was last on your podcast. So right around the time we were recording, my queerness was making itself known in a way that I could no longer ignore. And I was going through a time of restructuring my life in a way that allowed me to fully embody my own life. So I was encountering that who I was becoming was no longer sustainable, both in the ministry job I held, in the marriage that I had built, and in the work that I was about. So a season, I sometimes call these my weeping years, because there's a lot of tears, there's a lot of shedding. And what has happened in the years since has been that I am fully embodying my life. It's so beautiful to say that. Hello.
Yeah.
I'm fully living my life. I don't know. We'll find out if there are more shifts ahead. I'm always open to that, but I feel like I have been able to articulate and explore many of the things that I have been curious about and longing for. So what it means to be me right now is that I am a human who deeply, deeply loves the collective, and I am finding my place in the family of things. And the way that I do that, and I would say my vocation, is a midwife for change. I am someone who accompanies people through breakthroughs in the status quo, whether it's literally the birth that's happening in their bodies, or organizational shift in values, or worldview change, or death, which is the ultimate shift and the ultimate transition. So I accompany and come alongside folks. So I midwife those processes. And then over the last couple of years in my life, I've been playing a lot. So as I've been grieving a lot, I have necessarily had to explore play. And one of the primary ways I do that is as a disco skater. So I am a roller disco skater. I'm part of a skate crew. I go to adult skate nights. It's amazing. It's so fun. Very dancey, lots of footwork, and it's such an inclusive community. It's been so fun. And I'm also a parent. I have two beautiful, I call them boys for now. So Parker and Cedar, and when they draw me, they always draw me with roller skates on. So it's really becoming a part of my identity. So yeah, that's what it means to be me.
I love and appreciate that, and so honor both your sharing and your sharing as a person who is continuing to become. Like, I think that so much of often what it means to be us is to describe in definitive terms what we are and what we are not, rather than a more fluid journey of who we've been and who we are becoming. And I can hear in that even language of fully embodying your own life, that there is a space where you are able to embody your own life in some way, but the fullness of that is still something that is happening and becoming and being practiced, and that you're open to change in that. And I think that feels important to me, even as we have this conversation about consent, that there is this language even of becoming and being a changing person. Yes. And so much of the barriers, so many of the barriers to a culture of consent come from Christian cultures that assume that we cannot be changing people. That once we find a truth or once we find a reality, we have to sit in that reality forever. And that is somehow God's will. And so I'm hearing even in your storytelling, the reality and the undercurrent of consent, both in yourself and with other people who are receiving you in new ways, that is a present thing. And so I'm just interested even in how the language of what we're talking about is present in the undercurrent of the storytelling that you're doing.
Brilliant. Yep. Yeah. We are allowed to change our mind. And that is not something that the church taught me or encouraged me. And when we change our mind and we do that in relationships, that means we change protocol of how we engage with each other. And that is consent, is permission to proceed.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And we're going to get more into both the theological, the practical, the general, all of that. But one thing I want to name from the top in this conversation is that one of the things I've experienced as I've had conversations with people about consent or been in these conversations myself is that for folks listening, this conversation might make you think differently about your own experiences. Like if you are a person who has had your consent repeatedly or even individual experiences violated, there are ways that might bring up a lot of feelings. And so I encourage you to be gentle with yourself and kind to yourself in the memories that might come up, to pause as you need to pay attention to what your body is speaking to you, because that is even part of the practice of learning how to give and receive consent is figuring out what does it mean to accept the reality of our experiences and the things that are being offered to us. And so just know that there's tons of freedom in that in this conversation. And I realize in the inverse that some of us may realize, and I think this is a deeply grieving thing for many of us, that we may have violated others' consent. And there is a particular grief in recognizing that we've caused harm, and that there is room for that too in this conversation, even if that isn't the position that we privilege as people who will always lean toward thinking about those who have been harmed, but that there is a harm in being growing up and being part of cultures that teach us to be in some ways like assailants or folks who violate other people's consent. Yes. And so I want to name that both of those positions exist in the, probably in all of us at the same time. And so that there's room for that. And we're just trying to create points of intervention that allow us to do differently, knowing that who we have been doesn't have to be who we are. And that is true in our conversations about consent too. So that's my long way of saying there's a lot of room and there's a lot of questions here, but I want us to have space for the expanse and reality of where many of us are coming from, especially since many of us were given the cultures that we operate out of around consent from the church itself.
That's right. That's right. I was literally going to start this by saying I have caused harm in violating people's consent and am learning how to be someone who is shaping my integrity through consent. And I think there has to be grace here, because for so many of us, the bar is in the basement when it comes to understanding how to be in our bodies and what it means to be an embodied person, how to be sexual and what it means to be a sexual person. And then should we want to, how to engage with others sexually. And we'll talk about consent, not just in terms of sexuality. It's everywhere in all levels. And I think there has to be, for me, there's some ego disillusion and ego death in my faith evolution of moving from a place of a lot of arrogance around these topics to a place of a lot of humility and realizing like, here I am beginning again. And how am I might not feel competent, but these are skills that I can learn, and looking and seeking out relationships, that are seasoned with like direct communication and safety and container building where I can practice these skills that are not my inheritance and I was not socialized with.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I think that word practice is going to be one that is really central in a lot of how I invite people to engage with consent, knowing that there are tons of barriers to us being able to give and receive consent. And that when we start this conversation from a place of sex or sexuality, it's actually pretty unhelpful a lot of the time, because many of us, especially if you grew up in evangelical purity culture, have
a panic around any kind of conversation or any words spoken about sex. We assume like some kind of intuitive, metaphysical, spiritual thing that requires no communication, and then panic when we have to actually put words to the things that we're talking about. And so I know that we'll kind of go fluidly between talking about sex and other things and other parts of consent in our lives, and that feels important because many of us have just never been given the language for consent in other parts of our lives, or to even name how we are taught to violate consent in many parts of our Christianity or spirituality or whatever kind of Christian background you might have come from, whether that's cultural or a practice religious experience right now. And so I would love to get started a little bit with some definitions to get us on the same page. And I want to name too that as we talk about consent, there's not a single definition, but there are helpful tools and frames. And so I would love for us to give an expanse of ways of thinking about consent. So could you start us off by, talking about consent generally and in theology or Christianity or religiosity specifically, what is consent?
It's a big question, and I feel I'm only as qualified as I am. So the one qualification I would like to lay out is that I am a birth doula, and so I am someone who bears witness to conversations in the medical industrial complex around informed consent. And I think about my leadership in all the work I do around informed consent. So we'll come back to that. Not that I need to have a qualification per se. My lived experience certainly is a valid one, but that is something I'm going to bring into this conversation.
Yes.
And I would say if I'm rooted in that frame, which would be a body frame, I'm talking about bodies when I'm talking about consent. I think I used this language already briefly. To me, it is I am giving permission to proceed with an interaction, with touch, with an intervention, with a process, but I am recognizing my agency in this body that has a beginning and an end to proceed with you, individual in front of me, with you, collective in front of me. But I'm thinking a lot about agency when I think about consent.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. What about you? Absolutely. How do you?
Mine's really similar. Mm-hmm. Generally, I think about it as an agreement to engage. As a person who's a campus minister for a long time, I think there are ways that I taught people a lack of that. And so I think often more in spiritual terms before I think about it in sexual terms, where when I was taught to share the gospel or something, you just keep going until you get a no, or you keep asking till you wear someone down. And I think this agreement to engage was not a framework that I had in any part of life, let alone my Christianity, let alone my sexual life. And so it just feels like there was no way to, I think that I can just see the barriers that. So yeah, agreement to engage is my my baseline framework. And I think it stands in contrast to many other things. Again, lots of things get to be intuitive. And when you live in spiritual community and spiritual life, what you feel, even if you have no emotional awareness or help, matters much more than what you think or say or what you fully embody, what happens at the intersection of body, spirit, mind, all of that. And so I think I have lots of questions and curiosities about how consent is often viewed as either a fully verbal thing or a fully nonverbal thing, and that the intersection of those two things can be really helpful as we think about consent. And so do you have some frames that you use when you're thinking about what consent is or how consent looks in real time?
I love the framework that is not my own, but of an enthusiastic yes. And depending on the circumstance, that is verbal and nonverbal, and the need to repeatedly check in. And consent is not, I think of consent almost like the easy pass on a highway. It's not a one toll road. There are multiple checkpoints of checking in a process, because in any case, let's take it away maybe from physical or sexual experiences, but to emotional experiences. I experienced in the church a lot of unconsented emotional intimacy, emotional persuasion, and even I was thinking about this preparing for our conversation, even the coercive or covert invitation to go get coffee, right? That's kind of to go get coffee was the most consent you had. And if you consented to the coffee, you didn't really know. It was an informed consent. So yes, I did consent to show up and be here and sit down with you, pastor, ministry leader, whatever. But what happens next and how And I think about the somatic body response. Like, there are conversations I can go back to because my body remembers them because I was so unprepared for what was about to happen. Whether it was a conversation about my emotional immaturity as a leader or a conversation about that one time I got drunk and then I also preached the next Sunday. You know, like, moments that are important moments of accountability or relationality, but not that we were co-creating. So yes. When consent is violated, of course it creates a power dynamic where I no longer have agency to be exposed to whatever's happening in the room right now. And yes. Then my body is reacting in many different ways, usually for me, dissociation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And some of what I hear in that is that there's a hierarchy of values that is often playing out in those spaces where accountability comes over agency. And I don't think those have to be held in hierarchies. They can be held mm-hmm. together differently. And I think oftentimes if we believe that, like, accountability or morality or desire or even in sexual experiences, being affirmed by someone's assumed yes, mm-hmm. like all of those, I get placed in a hierarchy of values over another person's agency. Mm-hmm. And I think in Christianity, there are so many spaces where agency is shoved down to the lowest point over and over again because you're always yielding to a leader, to a yes. power, to a being higher than you that is always more right than you, that is always more able than you to say yes or no mm-hmm. for you. Mm-hmm. And so I think even as you use that word coercion, I think about how being able to give consent stands in contrast to the emotional, physical, and social pressures to say or even not say no in different situations. Mm-hmm. And many of us aren't actually given options about how or whether we want to move forward or not move forward in any part of our lives because of that lack of ability to consent in coercive environments where, like you're saying, a person, if you consent to going to coffee, may have power in that conversation because they have more knowledge, or they may have more power in that conversation because they have more of an awareness of the practical implications of what they're saying to you that you may not have going in. And so a lot of these conversations about consent also are conversations about power.
Yes, I don't, when I reflect on my years in evangelicalism, it feels difficult to say with 10 toes down that I could fully consent to anything because mm-hmm. I did not, looking back, it didn't feel like agency was really available to me. So the ideological mm-hmm. pressures, or I mean, literally, I think about the ministry organization I worked for where I signed that I wouldn't be gay. Like, how do you, mm-hmm. what does consent look like when you literally sign a contract that says, like, I will not follow intellectual or emotional or physical curiosity based on a conversation I'm having in my own body. So it is my platonic life partner and I joke a lot of the time, inappropriately so, about many life decisions we made when we were under the influence of evangelicalism and like, was yes. like, did we really consent to that? And that's for, of course, each person in their own faith journey to figure out for themselves
yes.
What agency means. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And like, per this kind of conversation around like definitions and like setting frameworks, I think I also want to name that there's a sort of a problematic way that we think about consent, which is that consent is just a choice that you make rather than a culture that we have to build. And so in this conversation, I want to hold the dual space of consent being a choice mm-hmm. and consent being a culture. Mm-hmm. And what I mean, I think by that is that, when consent is a choice, it gets framed down into no means no and yes means yes. And it puts the onus on the victim or the person without power to be explicit in their refusal mm-hmm. of an experience rather than affirmative in their consent. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't think about power dynamics when we think about consent as simply a choice. And it makes and affirms some kind of assumption that people can and should proceed in whatever they're doing until they're is a heard objection. Mm-hmm. And so people become objects to be moved on. And those are things that exist in a culture.
Yes.
And one of the things that I, one definition I've liked is Schiff's definition of consent culture, which is like a culture where all people are respected and have autonomy, mm-hmm. Choice and agency mm-hmm. to decide for themselves what is best and right for them.
Yeah.
So it affirms that people have the right to say what happens in their own body. Mm-hmm. And it gives people the capacity to practice mm-hmm. And protect their own bodily autonomy while also teaching other people in their yeses and nos and explanations to respect their agency. And so part of the conversation for us is both learning how to respect our own agency and and accept and express that agency, and to have plans and tools for how to respond when that's not the case, yeah. and where we will and will not show up anymore when that's not
yes.
the case. And so
yes.
I'm curious what you think about this.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you for that, because whiteness is hanging out in the corners of this conversation. So I'm thinking mm-hmm. about a couple of those, I think, now well-known characteristics of white supremacy, the Tema Okun document that lists mm-hmm. them, and thinking about the fear of confrontation as something that is mm-hmm. in the room when we cannot accept a no, and we don't know, we don't feel comfortable saying a no, and we don't collectively, and me, you know, as a white person, my people collectively have created a culture where we don't promote a no, because that would be confrontation, and that would mean shifting. And then the power dynamics you're talking about, which I love bringing that into this conversation, because then the collective responsibility is to create a culture where a no is more than acceptable. And I've seen that done well in some cases. I loved in one supervisory relationship I had, we had a weekly check-in that was digital, and there was a box in the check-in that was like, is there anything you want to bring up with me that you haven't known how to bring up, or like haven't felt comfortable? And having that ability to write it out to facilitate a conversation, that did flatten some power dynamics in a way that I thought was really helpful. So I think we've got to think about different people, different learning styles, different cultural communication, you know, and what's happening in that moment, and what people need. Because even like I've my vernacular, my culture around this has changed to ask someone if I can give them a hug before I hug them. Now, that's cool. That is a choice to start to build in some consent culture into my life. And I'm in a white body, and if it's a white body coming at you while they're asking you, can I give you a hug?
Yeah.
Like, is that really creating a chance for someone to actually say no? So I can walk away from that interaction and be like, I offered consent, you know, but I'm sure I would receive feedback from people of like, it doesn't really feel like I have an off-ramp from this interaction.
Right.
And I could workshop that and imagine other ways to do that. This is taking me down, if you don't mind, this other little thread I had, which is that I do think that on an interpersonal level, maybe what also leads us to shy away from consent as a culture is the fear of rejection. So if I'm coming towards you with my arms outstretched and you're like, I'm met with your boundary, how do I react? That would require me to have a secure sense of self, to know that we can remain connected in the ways that are appropriate and feel good to you, and that's not a hit on me, you know, which there's a lot of work we like individually and collectively need to do to move in that security.
I want to return to the conversation about rejection a little bit later, because I think there are so many parts about Christianity specifically in the West that thinks about rejection as a permission to say yes for the greater good and morality of other people or for the world. And so there are ways that even as we think about how we learn or do not learn to accept rejection, there are ways that we take it either personally or cosmically. Mm-hmm. And those are bigger things that I'd love to talk about in a bit if we come back to it. But one of the things that even as I was talking about in the beginning, there are so many ways that when we do not learn how to receive rejection well, we make it about ourselves rather than the skill sets that we have to manage what is a very natural part of life. Rejection is normal, and people get to either reject us or to change their minds about the experiences that they have with us. And when someone does change their mind or say no, it's an opportunity for me to be honest and responsible for my own feelings, to care for myself in ways that I need to care for myself when I experience rejection, because it's okay to feel disappointment or frustration when things don't go the ways that we hoped. I think about that clip in 500 Days of Summer, and in a terrible film, but there's this, the main character has this like split screen where he has these expectations of what happens when he reconnects with someone who he loved at one point, that she's going to receive him and like want to spend the night with him and be together. And what ends up happening on the other screen is that he's like rejected, kind of forgotten, not thought of. She's engaged to someone else. And he panics when his job really is to manage his experience of rejection, because it's normal. And instead of putting it on her and making it about her being a terrible person or trying to create a context where she might feel guilty or feel bad. That's not what that is. And so I think that part of learning rejection is to learn basic emotional management and awareness that says like, hey, that felt like something to me too. And that gets to take up space, but not more space than the reality of someone else's agency yes. or ability Absolutely. To say no to me.
Absolutely. Well said. Not in a way that would violate the boundaries that they have given you. And that's literally what it is a negotiation of us showing up with our needs and our wants and communicating that and where our boundaries lie and trusting that love will fill the space of that rejection and more alignment will come. But I was thinking about what were the things I was socialized in white evangelical Christianity that made that not possible? And there's this scripture that really haunted me. And I remember in the early dating years of dating my then husband, we had it posted on a post-it note above the bed. And it says, "Your body is not your own. You were bought at a price." And I'm sure there's much more context to that scripture. There's probably many ways to interpret it and integrate it. But that idea that my body isn't my own is something that I have had to reclaim since I have left the boundaries of Christianity, as some would call it. And reclaiming my body as my own allows me to reclaim others' bodies as their own. It is absolutely mutually tied up in one another. And especially as a white-bodied person, the legacy of overriding the consent of other people's bodies and dehumanizing other people's bodies, it is very important to go through a healing time of learning what it means to be in a body that has a beginning and an end. There's like infinite, I think, lessons and good medicine there. So,
That's so true. Well, I would love to talk a little bit about how we learn consent or not learn consent. And I would have this conversation like in a more spiritually neutral place, but I think us having this conversation where we're talking about how we learn or do not learn consent in general and in church space and church culture, the scriptures, because you're already bringing some scriptures into the conversation on that, which I love. I'm wondering if we can talk a little bit about that. And this conversation, I'm sure, will intersect with things like patriarchy and violence and all of those things. And so, yes, how do we learn consent or a lack of consent? What are some touch points that you have for some of the epistemological learning spaces? Like how do we know the world? How do we know consent in the world? How are we becoming and all of that? So I'll keep using my college words to be like, so how do we learn this shit? Yeah, like, what is that?
I can just share my story, which is I'm learning this as I am reparenting myself through parenting my kids and what that has looked like. And I know for a lot of millennial parents, where something's happening in the collective, that a lot of us are focused on teaching our kids bodily consent. That, of course, pairs with like socio-emotional consent. So starting from a really young age of teaching my kids little catchphrases about themselves, like, I am the boss of my own body. I get to check in with my body. And we use it in a variety of ways. So, of course, there's the classic example of a relative coming in for a hug, like what we were describing earlier, and valuing the agency of my children and teaching them how to say no to a scenario like that. There's also checking in with what is my body telling me about fullness and eating and not forcing my kids to eat. Hopefully not creating a disordered relationship with food and with their own body. And that consent extends to me. So I ask my kids, can I give you a kiss? I would love to snuggle with you. Do you want to do that now or would you like to do something else? And they have that ability and trust with me to choose, no, I don't want to right now. I'll do so later if I want to. So while I'm teaching my kids who are at the start of their lives about their bodies and about consent, it really is applying that to my adult self. And
Yes.
That has shown up. Astrologically, I'm a very watery person, so some of your listeners will know what that means, but I'm a very deep, deep feeler, and I feel everything on both sides of the spectrum deeply, and that means that I have to be someone who is very conscious of consent in my emotional relationships. And so when I am going to reach out to a friend, usually I'll text them and be like, hey, do you have capacity to hear me weeping and hold space with me weeping, because that's where I'm at right now, you know, before. So I'm breaking the habit of assuming and sort of assaulting my community with my emotional needs without checking in on how the hell they're doing, if they have capacity, and if they want to come alongside and hold space. Right. So I think part of, like, any life change, there's going to be a time of awareness building where you start to see your own patterns and you start to see your own habits, and you're like, wow, I am really noticing ways that I am entering into other people's space without their permission. And you start to correct that. And I think that happened for me in my anti-racism work as a white person, of realizing that not every space is for me. There are boundaries, and asking consent about, can I come hang in that space, you know? It really, I've been thinking a lot about ontological expansiveness. It's been sitting with me for the last couple months around, which is a academic phrase that describes the idea that white folks are born with this sense, this colonizing sense, that every space is ours and that there's no place we cannot go. And so I guess maybe what I'm working out with you as we're talking through this is that there are many pathways to consent. And there are going to be a lot of life circumstances that lead us there, whether it is racial consciousness and awakening, sexual purity and sexual exploration, queerness, parenting, emotional codependency. You're going to hit a point where you realize that you need to have boundaries and you need to respect other people's boundaries. And the bridge between those things is consent.
Yes, and we're going to be talking about boundaries and how to set boundaries and know what your boundaries, what boundaries are helpful for you, and how to develop that in this season, which I'm really looking forward to. But one of the things I really appreciate about what you're saying is that, and I think this is really helpful in some of the lack of consent culture that we've been given in evangelical spaces, is that my needs and desires do not constitute someone else's capacity or interest. My needs and desires do not constitute someone else's capacity or interest, and I cannot know what their capacity or interest is until I ask them. And I think so many times I've ended up in situations where I'm way over my head in someone else's stuff, and I haven't consented to being in that space. And so I've been making it a practice in my own life to say, hey, do you have capacity for this type of conversation, or this conversation, or hey, when would be a good time to have this conversation? It's something I'm still growing in, because it's teaching me to practice that my feelings don't get to be the ultimate center of someone else's life, nor of my relationships with other people. And that there is, like you're saying, that word, a negotiation of what is appropriate, what is good, what is healthy, what is meaningful. And I think that that's been really interesting for me to do when I grew up, like, you know, I kind of split my time in Christianity between Pentecostal space, like house of prayer spaces, and like conservative Baptist white evangelicalism. And so this shows up differently in those spaces. Where, like, in my Pentecostal spaces, I was taught to pay attention to my internal cues, but to always interpret those as the Holy Spirit. And so there was something in me that was always right and always good, because the Spirit was always moving in me. And so I could fully trust what was happening inside of me when it might have just been my feelings or my something else going on for me, not actually the Holy Spirit. And then in white evangelicalism, I was taught that your heart is deceptive above all things. You can't trust anything about what you feel. So everything gets pushed outside of your body. And so for those of us who grew up in any of those spaces or an intersection of those spaces, the messages around our internal cues and what it means to actually know what it would mean to give consent are really, really, really confusing. And it teaches us that there are ways that we should always or should never listen to ourselves. And those are both not helpful binaries. And that it makes it really hard to make decisions that honor our limits. And I think that's where some of white supremacy culture in me still, like, it's something I'm still unearthing, which is the idea of a sense of urgency, that we are taught in a culture of urgency, whether it's about sharing the gospel or like sex or intimacy or whatever, to push beyond our limits for the sake of like an intangible future or an intangible outcome. And so there's ways that we're taught that we're supposed to give a constant yes to God all the time without question. And that's how God saves the world. And so it makes sense to me that it would be hard to honor our own limits and honor our own decisions when the thing that we're taught most about God is that God wants our compliance, our obedience, and not our participation and our negotiation of relationship. And so part of my own life with God has been asking the question, what does it mean to be in conversation about my own body, my own life, rather than just saying, God, what do you want from me or for me? And those questions have been fundamentally reframing how I think about consent with people, because it makes me ask the question, those same questions, like, what does it mean to be in relationship? Not just what do we want from or for each other? Because that kind of transactional language, while present in many parts of Western culture and in the church, is not particularly helpful for evading like kind of harmful practices and cultures that we're a part of.
Whew. There was so much right there. I think that what I'm hearing is like, we are socialized to assume that we know, and we don't know. Mm-hmm. So,
absolutely.
Especially if we're thinking about the intersection of white theology, right? Which is like objective, all knowing. Like, yeah. What if you don't know? What if you don't know you don't actually know what makes your friend feel loved? And so intimacy is built by asking questions and getting to know that. Maybe you don't, this gets to gender. You don't know what pronouns someone uses or what compliment would feel right to them. Like, one of my favorite things to do with my partners is ask them, like, what kinds of adjectives make you feel good? I want to know. Because I want, when I am telling you how into you I am, I want it to be in a language that you understand, I want that to hit you right there. And I don't want to assume what that is. And so there is it is undoing the ways that we think we know. And I want to add and a trigger warning here around sort of rape culture, that we have been socialized, especially romantically and sexually, with an idea that there's something sexy about assuming and asserting assumption over someone else. And that can make the transition to consent culture clunky, I have to say. And absolutely. I am like deeply Pentecostal intuitive. Like, I am an evangelical witchy person who still speaks in tongues, you know? So like, yeah, that shit is deep within me. But the need to challenge my assumptions and to do so in every level, sexual, romantic, and platonic ways of relating to people, and to check in and to be like, does this feel loving to you? Or even for ourselves, I think this becomes a part of our body awareness of like, how is my body reacting to this person? Am I going into fight or flight consistently around this person? And let's get curious about that. Like, what is that? So to me, consent is about creating safety for people. And it's about knowing and getting to know people on their terms.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Yes. And I think that I just want to name some of the practical cultural things that contribute to that. Like the idea that a surprise kiss in media is romantic. Like there's this like moment in a lot of rom-coms where a pair is fighting, like a hetero couple is fighting, and she turns to walk away and he grabs her arm and then pulls her in for a kiss, and she resists it first, but then suddenly is like into it. And so there's ways that this like assumption that if I just create a moment of intimacy, things will get better, rather than saying I'm creating an assaultive moment of intimacy that she has no power to get out of. And so I think even though like music is used in media and all of those create framings that make predatory behavior seem normal and romantic. And that happens a ton in the church. And so there are a couple of things that come to mind when I think about that. One is just that, again, all of us, I think, can do to have more emotional awareness of ourselves and of reading other people's emotional worlds while not assuming that we know what those
are. Correct.
Paying attention, like learning to read body language and to experience shift. Like, I can tell, like, when I'm hugging someone I love and something is happening for them, I can feel that in their body. I may not know what's happening, but I can then step back and ask, hey, it feels like something's happening for you that's different than it might normally be for you. Do you want to talk about that? Or, like, what's happening for you? Or I'm experiencing like you wanting this thing in this way. Am I right in assuming that? Or like, is that what you're communicating to me in that? And those things I think are seen as entirely unromantic because they mm-hmm. slow down. Like they seem, or they appear as though they mm-hmm. slow down some level of like mm-hmm. physical intimacy when what they create is emotional safety that I think enhances physical Correct. Intimacy. And so there are lots of ways that as we learn to discuss our emotions, both for ourselves and for others, that we undo a lot of things that I think are pretty fundamentally also tied up in binary gender assumption. I think women are taught to read between the lines, assume and anticipate men's needs and to keep men from blowing up by doing all these like subtle, indirect things all the time. So I would actually say like, those who are socialized as feminine. Yes. I think that would be a more accurate way to talk about that. And that then those who are socialized into masculinity are normalized into moving past those things, having their needs met, moving into patterns of domination, proving their manliness by participating in a taking culture, by assuming that masculinity equals sexual prowess, and then putting language like from the don't deny each other, or your desire will be for your husband, or making jokes about Song of Songs, or elevating men in scripture as not being as problematic as they are in order to live mm-hmm. out masculinity mm-hmm. in a particular way. And so I think like those things cut off men from needing to, or those who are socialized as masculine, from engaging with their emotional world, particularly when mm-hmm. it comes to sex, because sex is framed as this like rite of passage. Yes. And there is then this built-in assumption that men all want sex, mm-hmm. which is not true for our mm-hmm. ace community. That isn't true for like a lot of men in general who don't have the same sex drive as mm-hmm. they're framed in mm-hmm. church spaces. And all of these produce kind of domineering mm-hmm. narratives that cut men off from emotional awareness. And so I think that the gender binary things play a pretty significant role in how our interest in, ability in, knowing each other's emotional worlds plays out. It's part of where I think that queerness can be really helpful in reframing mm-hmm. a lot of those things, but it doesn't take away the pervasive culture of gender binaried emotional disillusionment in church spaces.
And I just from my own experience going from performing cis straight culture for many years of my life to pressing into my queerness, that turning that corner, all you know is toxic masculinity. And so it can feel, especially if you're someone who's more likely to initiate, I feel like I'm scanning myself. I'm like, is this predatory or is this naming my desire and pursuing mm-hmm. it? Like, I don't know. You know, this is a very vulnerable space to enter into. And yeah, I think for all of us, there's redemption available in all of these ways we've learned to be with each other. But it does, and I think this connects to trauma, because a lot of what you were naming are trauma responses, hypervigilance mm-hmm. around emotional landscapes, the ways, you know, we sometimes label ourselves as empaths when it's like, my love, you have a lot of trauma, and you're very good at reading a room. But I have a partner right now who my instincts about what they are thinking or feeling are almost always wrong. So I'm learning so much about direct communication, and I feel like consent and being mindful of consent will teach you and will hold up a mirror to the ways that we frankly are trying to manipulate our way into connection, or we are being really indirect about our desires. And we are, you know, this whole series is about purity culture, where especially everybody, I would say, especially those socialized as women, but truly everyone in that system is shamed away from desire, from understanding what your desire is, from naming it and how to appropriately seek it out. And I think so. I mean, the original question we were tossing around here is like, how do you start to learn this stuff? And it is through awareness and noticing with love. I want it to be rooted in love for all of us, because shame is a pretty shitty motivator for transformative change. Mm-hmm. And I think it's okay to repeatedly remind yourself as you make this shift that you're new here. And that is a very humbling yes. reality. Like, I remember feeling a couple years ago, I was like, I feel like I'm a sex positive educator for women who are recovering from purity culture. Now I don't even identify as a woman, and I feel very humbled about being a sex positive person, because it is like spiral dynamics over here. There's always something new that I'm learning. There's always a way I'm being humbled and understanding how little I know. I hope it's okay to offer this. Edit it out if it's not. But we could learn a lot from well-done practices in the kink community that are actually highly orchestrated to create safe moments that are highly consent-based. And it's a huge cultural yes. misunderstanding that those are places of dehumanization. And this is a broad strokes, because there are many kinky spaces that are dehumanizing, I am sure. But my understanding and, you know, minimal exposure is that these are ways that adult people with adult sexualities engage with each other, with direct communication, clearly stating boundaries ahead of time, like highly, highly protective spaces that then the limitations allow for liberation and allow for freedom and play that is mutually beneficial and good. Just food for thought about.
Which I think is actually mm-hmm. really helpful, because I think one of the things that's challenging, especially I think for queer folks who are out later because mm-hmm. of evangelicalism, what happens is that like consent and exploration are often put into binaries. Where exploration is framed as intuitive and consent is framed as practical. And so it's hard to know what you do or do not want unless yeah. you've experienced something. And so like the ability to or to not give consent mm-hmm. gets complicated in that you may give consent to something and then not enjoy it and may not want to do that thing again. Or you may give consent in a moment, and as you're in the midst of something, may need to withdraw yes. your consent in those moments. And I think because many of us are exploring what we do or do not want, there are things that feel practically challenging to engage with that I think can trigger a lot of shame for folks. And what I appreciate about things like the kink community, or even just some of like the more, if we want to go like more approachable to more people, like when I think about like Afrosexology's checklists and books or Erica Smith's resources, there are places to say, list 10 things you want in a physically intimate experience. And a lot of us were never taught to think about those things at all. And many of us might be able to name like two, you know, like we're starting wherever we are. But there's a way that naming what we think we might want gives us space to both express what we might want and to explore those things in ways that create mm-hmm. safe environments. And so what I'm hearing you describe is that in kink spaces, you create mm-hmm. fences that you know that you're all That's right. staying in. And if you're staying in those fences, it doesn't mean that you're doing all, yeah. that you're going to do yeah. everything within those fences, but it means that the fencing is a way of creating, one means of creating safety in a yeah. broader experience. And so I think that many of us can mm-hmm. do that in smaller ways by listing what we mm-hmm. want, knowing what we want in some ways, or saying, here's something I'm mm-hmm. interested in exploring. Right. And I don't know what it looks like to explore that thing, but, and mm-hmm. that could be anything. Like that could be kissing mm-hmm. someone. That could be sitting in an emotionally yeah. intimate space. That could be watching mm-hmm. a movie, you know, like it could be anything. And so there's ways that I think we can start to name and interpret exploration through the lens of consent, rather than pushing those things into binaries and being like, well, I can't know what I do or do not That's want right. until I do something. Because I think there are things that can be known. And if we can name the things that can be known, it can help us to engage with the things that cannot be known until we experience them in an embodied way.
So good. I wonder if it would be fruitful to bring in informed consent at this time and how that might be different. Okay. So in my work as a birth doula, birth doulas are perinatal coaches, educators. We offer informational support. We don't offer clinical support. So midwives or OBs are doing like the work, the body work of the birth, but we are doing accompaniment. And in accompaniment, mm-hmm. I am coaching people, especially if they're birthing in a hospital, what consent really means. And informed consent. So we've been talking about consent as permission to proceed, as invitation, enthusiastic invitation to engage. Mm-hmm. To take it a step further, are the risks and benefits of whatever's coming next known? And have I consented with some sense of clarity of what it is that I am consenting to? So in a birth setting, just a practical example would be if something is happening with my labor that might suggest the use of Pitocin, which is synthetic oxytocin, to increase the intensity of my contractions, do I know what the benefits of that will be in this moment and what the risks are? And the benefits could be that it speeds up my labor and I meet my baby soon. The risks could be that it causes uterine prolapse or damage to the uterus because my body wasn't ready for it. Like, that's a huge scope of possible outcomes. Yeah, sure. Did I know that, and did someone explain that to me in a way that I could understand? And I've been bedside at many different circumstances where informed consent is driven by legality. Like, cover your ass legality and not the human dignity of the person in front of you. And I think we can extrapolate this to topics that your community on this podcast interact with a lot, which is like faith communities, right? Do you have informed consent when you are entering into a church community? Have they been clear about ideologies that might be important to you? You know, the clarity is kindness movement, right? Of church clarity, having like some centralized hub on the internet where you can see if churches are queer affirming or not and where they're at. You know, I don't know much more than that about that resource, but I think about this in many facets of life. So I am someone who tends to start new communities and lead them. Am I giving informed consent with what I know from the jump? This is what your participation would mean. This is the possible benefit to you, and this is the possible risk to you. And we do this in research. Like, if you're doing qualitative research, you need to give that out to your participants. Like, known effects of the study are, you know, like, yes. So this starts to move into a place also of like leadership and community building, of like, what is our responsibility as people with influence to make clear to folks, to honor their agency, to opt in or out at all levels of community engagement with us? And how does that then create, I would assume, more healthful communities, at least more honest communities. I know why I'm here, yes. And I know what to expect while I'm here. Feels so important. And I do think, man, I learned a lot of manipulation tactics from the church of how to like skirt those conversations, yes. And not just present like, here's what you're going to get from us and here's what you're not, you know?
Yeah. Yep. 100%. Well, and I would love actually to pivot a little bit. It's funny that we haven't actually talked about this as explicitly, because I think that there's a huge way that purity culture gets in the way. Purity culture specifically gets in the way of giving people the option of informed consent. Like that kind of gets in the way of consent in general. And so I'm wondering if we can talk about some of like Christian culture, scripture things that make this really challenging. Because I think for many of us, it's not just, I think a lot of us are pretty good at rejecting the scripture, but we're not good at unlearning the culture. And that's okay, and that makes a lot of sense to me. And one example that comes to mind, like in my communities growing up, the best thing that men could be in the church was a pursuer of God and a pursuer of women specifically. And what I think that created was a culture of predatory persistence, where the amount of times that I've been like at a wedding space where someone is talking about how in like these like weird romantic terms, someone wore someone else down, that she resisted at first, but his love covered, just Jesus's love. And so the framing gets to be really, really bizarre. And there's a way that predatory persistence is framed culturally as being romantic. That even I think about like the usage of the like the Hosea scripture.
Yeah.
And the book, what's that book that that was written about? It has like a lady with a red dress in the front.
I don't know. Yeah.
Redeeming love. Mm-hmm. Redeeming love. Like that book was so popular when I was growing up because it was this romanticization of pursuing someone who was less than and showing them real love. And so there was a way men were taught to, I think, love bomb, like affection bomb women in the community in order to get their affection. Mm-hmm. And so I think predatory behavior is hard for us to unlearn because we've been taught in an innate sense that certain things are romantic that are really predatory or unhelpful. And then we're given stories about how that worked for other people and how they're still married to their spouse 20 years later. And I'm like, okay, I believe in creators' ability to do a redemptive arc in all things, and it doesn't mean that that strategy wasn't super jacked up.
Like maybe let's not perpetuate it.
Yes, and I think even about how the scripture around like Jacob with Leah and Rachel is used for that. Jacob worked 14 years for Rachel and just had this little hiccup of another woman in his life. Or I think there's a lot of things that are like that, where what is supposed to be romantic in scripture that is actually kind of very bizarre is framed as something to pursue as pursuers.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so, I mean, if we were to get to a consent culture, there would need to be a willingness to lay that power down. And I think there is something very alluring about, I'm feeling very crass right now. You can edit this out, but it's like that like big dick energy of like, I get to move in this way. I get to have authority and agency over you in this way. And that is supported, by this echo chamber of how I'm reading the scriptures, what is supported and vaulted up socially. Like, yeah, in my exit from evangelicalism, there were a lot of old boys clubs that I got to bear witness to, especially as a then white lady who drank whiskey. It was like a little access point to some really pretty horrifying spaces where, yeah, the way that folks would talk about their spouses and their partners was really horrific. And then being hit on in those spaces, you know, as a femme in those spaces. And yeah, I don't know. I think that consent as a culture necessarily decentralizes power, because now we're getting into, now we're co-creating. Now, I if you say no, I respect your no. And we're going to find, if we want to keep connecting, we're going to find another way to connect. Or we're not going to connect anymore. And that doesn't bode well for hierarchical leadership structures, where I need you to do what I tell you to do. So, yeah. It does seem like it's a bit of a secret sauce for changing things. Do you feel, Brandy, do you feel like you're experiencing good consent culture in the church spaces that you interact in? Or have there been moments that you could turn to and be like, this was actually done well, and that felt dignifying? And
honestly, I'm not really sure. I think I can see people trying, and I can see, I think when you ask the question like a pointed way, I'm like, maybe not at the center, but I can see the ways that things are changing around that space. I can see more agency, space for agency being created. So like, when I think about how a community kit, like my community that I'm in right now, has decentered patriarchy in a big way. So men's experiences and feelings are not the most important thing in the room. Men are not the star, their intentions aren't centered, and they're not the way in which God saves the world. And so when patriarchy isn't at the center of a community, it is easier to give consent or to pay attention to where like people's feelings get to have a space in it, or like where we get to say no, or where one central leader doesn't get to make a the decisions for everybody in the room. And so I think my community is highly collaborative. And so I think, and I'm struggling because I'm not particularly collaborative enough myself, but I'm learning how collaborative culture creates more room, and more voices create room for a more expansive means of consenting. I also think that the way that we engage with scripture has been really one of those helpful, like, again, it's not the center question, but it's like the culture around it, where we typically in my community don't read the text as character models, like people who are character models. And I think a lot of the preaching I grew up with was, here's David. David's the Christ figure in the text. Now be like him. Or like, we were always looking for, it's a particular type of biblical interpretation that's always looking for a Christological model. Namely, you're always looking for the character who looks most like Christ, because it's an anti-Semitic way of reading the text. It says that Jesus is present in all of the like Hebrew scriptures in these different ways that it's clearly not helpful. But I think when you're looking for a Christ type, even implicitly in all of the text, you're always looking to a character to be your model, rather than reading the text for principles that would help us to do life with Creator differently. And so as I see my community doing that, I'm seeing there being more avenues for how to be in the world. And when there's more avenues for how to be in the world, it's much easier to say yes or no, because we're not all exposed to a one right way mentality. And I think that, which I think is really, really helpful. And then I think maybe the one other thing that has been helpful as we've done non-patriarchal work is that in a lot of non-consent culture, women or femmes are viewed, even if not explicitly, because I know no one's like thinking this for the most part, like obviously there's extremes, are objects to be bartered with. And that's true in the text. And so because the text has a patriarchal bent to it, women end up being machines that give wind to the dreams of men, namely continuing their lineage. And so every person who is femme is movable as is serviceable to the greater good of the community. And because we've undone that, there's a lot more room to just be, to let people be, to let people's wants, needs, and boundaries take priority over the mission itself. And so I think when the mission gets decentralized and people's wants, needs, and boundaries get prioritized, consent is much easier and a consent culture is more able to be created.
Well said. Well said. Yes. Cosign. I agree. what are... I'm just deciding. I'm a host now.
That's fine.
Thank you. I'm host. Wow. But what are resources that have helped you to learn about consent? And I'll share mine.
Yeah, you know, for what it's worth, listeners, I told E, feel free to ask questions back. So they're not colonizing the podcast after being like, anti-colonization work. We explicitly had this conversation before. So if you're like, boo, please don't.
Thank you for naming that.
We had this conversation before. Of course. I set you up for failure on that, pretty much is what I'm saying. Well, one of the things is just like, I've been learning to practice naming and saying my desires and needs. And practicing saying no in low stakes environments. Because I think that, like, do I want this food? Yes. No. Yes. Those things are really helpful. Like, because then I can name certain things. And some framing questions that have been helpful for my own somatic experience of it are, what does a no or a yes feel like in my body? What does an enthusiastic yes feel like in my body? What in me in other experiences of my life have made me say yes or no when I've wanted to say otherwise? Like, as I've been a part of purity culture, are there ways that I've said no when I may not have wanted to? Or are there ways that I've said yes in environments that I have not wanted to say yes to? And I think I'm looking back on a lot of my experiences and seeing a lot more manipulation and coercion in leadership, intimate spaces, all of those in my life, because there were a lot of things that kept me from being able to say no in ways that I would have wanted to, and that those have produced guilt and shame. And so in me, even though there were conditions that weren't necessarily in my control. And so I've been having to do a lot of the unlearning work and the self-love work of, and the prayer work, frankly, and journaling work of, why have I said yes? And can I have grace for myself for making the best decision I could to protect myself in that moment, even if it's not something that I would do again?
That's right.
And so I think those kinds of questions of like, what do these things feel like in my body? And what does exploration feel like? It has been really interesting, like, especially as I'm exploring my queerness in new ways, I'm just asking lots of questions about like, how does this feel different? How does this feel the same? What do I know I intellectually want? But how does my body respond when I actually pursue the things that my mind might want? Like, I might think I want something, but when I'm experiencing it, it might feel different than what my mind anticipated. And can I take moments in, during, and after those moments to say, that wasn't what I expected. Where is the disconnect? And what am I learning about myself in this moment? And so the goal for me in practicing consent culture in that way has not been necessarily to know like what exactly like my hard yeses and hard nos are. That's important too. But I think for me in the exploration, it's more been learning to retrust my body's ability to know what's best for me and to prioritize, like I said before, my own needs and wants and boundaries. And the needs, wants, and boundaries of people I'm interacting with as I go. And to give people opportunities who I'm interacting with to be able to do the same thing. So a question I've been practicing asking a lot is like, how are you feeling in your body? And in allowing myself to feel like interruptive or like slowing down a process, not even just like sexual or intimate experiences, but like all experiences. Like, how are you feeling in your body in this conversation? How are you feeling in your body in this experience? How... like, are there ways that I can make more room for you to fully exist in this space? And those things open me up for rejection or for awkwardness or for tension. But I think I'm learning that I would rather have awkwardness and tension and communication, because it creates more space for love and affection and care and safety and security. And that's been super important for me.
That's right. I think the thing that we're healing, well, it's many things, but it is... living and being socialized during our most tender years in a system that told us what to do with our bodies, that denied the body consciousness as a legitimate way of knowing. And really, for me, like, divorced myself from my body. Like, I did not know, touch, or practice, like, any awareness of my sexual body until I was married to a man. And that being divorced from your body sucks, has wide-reaching implications. Mm-hmm. For me, it did not create the intimacy that I was promised it would create. It did the very opposite. And so now, I am in a repair process with my body. And that is, consent is such a powerful thing because it does hand power back to the people. And I love, Adrienne Marie Brown talks about, trust the people and they will become trustworthy. And it is returning agency and dignity and self-determination to the people to say, like, we actually have all that we need to discern this well. And it is going to take it. It will be a process of regenerative process, a reparative process of healing, what that relationship looks like. And I think you laid that out so beautifully, practically, you know, of how to reparent, how to care for ourselves again. And, you know, and I can hear, because it still lives in me, I can hear the voices of, like, white male Calvinists being like, no, like, that is the road to anarchy and chaos, and nothing good can come from people using their own discernment, which is what you were mentioning about the white Christians being like, the heart is wicked, you know, nothing can be, no, there's nothing good here. And that's not what I believe about God, and that's not what I believe about our bodies. I think that the gifts of learning how to ask for consent, how to create relationships and spaces where people do feel safe enough saying no, is, like you said, it's like, that's actually a doorway to a much more beautiful reality, because we are not performing here. I kept thinking of fawning, the fawning reflex, which is a survival tactic to, like, woo your predator so that they don't destroy you. Mm-hmm. Like, we have to undo that. Yes. And part of undoing that is going to be braver about our limitations. And that ultimately is so loving to yourself and to the people that you are doing life and community with. And there has, like, may grace go with us, because there's going to be overcorrecting in all directions. So
absolutely.
I get to do life with my platonic life partner, and we own a home together and we raise our kids together. And my niece Milani was running through my half of the duplex the other day, and she'll do, like, full-bodied cartwheels, and, like, just is, like, you just feel like she is fully embodied. And while she's doing this, she's going around the apartment shouting, I love making mistakes.
Oh my gosh, that's the best.
Like, dreads bouncing, cartwheel flipping, I love making mistakes. That's the image I want to, you know, invoke in y'all. And, like, that deeply offended my soul. I was like, I do not love making mistakes. Like, and I want to learn from you, Milani, and I want to learn from your wisdom that, I think that that will probably be our greatest enemy as we turn the corner, in the humility that we're new here in our sexual selves post-purity culture, is, like, we've got to be okay making mistakes. And learning from them and repairing harm when we inevitably cause it. But yeah, it's okay. We're going to be okay.
Yes. And I want to give a specific word about that to folks who, because I think a lot of us who are unlearning purity culture are just like, I, and this framing has been very, very hard for me, because it's not who I am as a person, but where it's like, you leave purity culture and the thing that you need to do is have a hoe face so you can explore yourself. And for most of us, we're honestly too fucking fragile for that.
Yeah.
Like, we're just too fragile to be exploring this stuff in environments that aren't, like, safe and connective and comfortable. And so for folks who have just heard, like, the inverse to purity culture is to just go out and, like, do whatever, most of our bodies are a little too tender for that. And for some people, sure. But, like, I think the vast majority of people I talk to are like, wow, that did not work for me. And so just know that there are other ways of being. And I think practicing consent can actually help us do that, to ask what kind of relationships and intimacies feel safe for us, that don't just require us like throwing everything that we've learned out the window all at one time and replacing it with something that may also be deeply problematic for us. And so I want to name too that like one of the main things that I think we have to unlearn in that is that someone always knows better than you do about what your body needs. Because I think the inverse, like the contrast I'm setting here, right, is in like a hoe phase, it's like, oh, progressive, abstract people out there know that you're going to be like so liberated after you have that experience. Or it's Christian leaders get to tell you what's best for your body and get to tell you what the most fulfilling and satisfying life is going to be for you. And I think in the in-between space really is what you're talking about, is this like explorative space to make mistakes and to check in often, to be in therapy, to be engaging with yourself, and to know. I think the thing I want people to know about like Creator is that Creator is not as fragile as evangelicalism has set Creator up to be. I think I was taught all of my life that the thing that I could most do to Creator was like grieve Creator or dishonor or shame Creator or be a bad witness. And I was like, Creator is good all by God's self, is able to hold the world all by God's self. And that our exploration, our mistakes, our chaos are not too big to outdo the love of Creator. And I think that like Creator's love covers us in this process if we would let it. And that I think that just means that like Creator can hold our expectations and our exploration and our disappointment. And that having that view of God that says like, oh, I can have an experience that I would not do again, or I can make a mistake, or I can engage differently than I thought I would, or I can explore something, is a really freeing place to be. And I think actually honors Creator's love for us that can cover a multitude of sins.
You know, Amen. Bible. Amen.
Like, and so I just like want folks to know that.
Yes. I do have another thought, but that felt like a really good ending point as well. So,
I mean, feel free to offer. Yeah, if there's, I was going to ask if you had any other thoughts that you wanted to give as we're closing out our time.
I'm like, oh my God. I was just going to say that something that we were robbed of was healthy sexual identity development, like at an age appropriate level. So, I just wanted to add that while there's a lot to grieve there, what I am also learning as I have left the shores of purity culture, is that my years in the church and my years building up tons of other muscle groups when I was celibate, and really focusing on platonic relationships and community. And I think there are transferable skills and even some good medicine that we are bringing with us to other people. Mm-hmm. And I don't want us to only believe that we are damaged and that nothing can be redeemed from that experience. Like, it actually... I think that I have co-created some really beautiful dynamics because of my deep commitment to human dignity that I do credit Creator with, you know, this idea of being made in God's image, and that any person I'm having a connection with is also made in God's image. And so that dignity driving the consent that I am curious about and asking about and giving and also, I mean, I think we can be pretty good communicators because we've had a lot of time to think about this shit.
Absolutely.
So
absolutely.
I just wanted to add into the shared bucket of knowing that we do bring some cultural gifts to the table from some very confusing places, and that, we can go with some assurance there. Yeah.
I so appreciate that. It's one of those things where it's really easy to discard everything that we've learned instead of going, well, actually, like, the evangelical institution that we both worked for gave us some pretty good activism skills and some, like, critical thinking skills and interpretive skills that I can carry even if there's parts of that I have to let go. And I love and am passionate about us holding the nuance of our experiences and not dishonoring the whole of our experiences for the things that were harmful or problematic. And I know sometimes people have to do that, but I think for most of us, we hold those things in tension together and glean what Creator would have for us, like the redemptive edges that Creator would have for us, instead of just like saying that everything's trash, because that is very bothersome to me and kind of unrealistic for every other part of our life. Yet we feel pretty confident doing it with our religiosity. And so I'm just holding space for that in between. And I'm so grateful for this conversation and for space to start to think about these things, because I think for many of us, and we're going to have more practical resources on like how to develop and grow in consent, these questions that you can ask yourself, ways of engaging differently. But this type of conversation feels really helpful just to reframe, or maybe frame for the first time for some of us, what this is and how to do it, because we hear the language in the ether and assume that we should just know it by osmosis, when this is a deeply emotional, embodied work that we have to practice over and over again with ourselves and with our own bodies and with others. And it is a way that we come back to places of pleasure. At the end of the day, like, that is one of the things that it comes back to for us. And so I want to just name that there is actually a lot of hope and life on the other side of what can be a really, really, really awkward place of learning and exploration. And so, E, I'm so grateful for your time and your wisdom in this. And I'm wondering if you would like, if there's anything you'd like to plug, where can people find you out in these streets?
That's great. Thank you for having me. Thank you for having me again. It's so good to be in conversation. And I always share this podcast as a resource with people who are going through their own shifts. I'm so, like, the work you are doing is deeply important and it really matters. So thank you for continuing to do it. Yep. I am not the most visible person on the internet right now. I think just the number of life shifts over the past few years have meant in some scrubbing some of my internet presence and keeping some of it. If you search Erin Corey Cole, you'll find sort of a smattering of podcasts, blog posts, places that I am. Ezra Birth Collective is the umbrella for the work that I do as a birth and death doula. We're in the middle of a rebrand. So you're going to go to the website, EzraBirthCollective.com, and you're going to hit a landing page with nowhere to go. So you can stay tuned on those places because I am very much in transition and in the vulnerable turn of showing up again to more public conversation. And this is a part of that. So thank you for hosting that space for me to do that and to be here.
I'm so delighted. So good. Thank you so much for being on today. I appreciate Cheers. It so much. Thank you for listening to another episode of Reclaiming My Theology. If you like what you hear, as always, you can subscribe, rate, review, or simply tell a friend. It all goes a long way to helping folks find the show. You can also help us keep the show going by joining us on Patreon at patreon.com/reclaimingmytheology. We also want to continue being a curious community and to talk about the things that you're mulling on. So if you have questions, always feel free to email us a question, typed out, or a voice memo at reclaimingmytheology@gmail.com. In the midst of all that's going on in the world, it's ever more important that we continue to hold each other well, to do this work not just for ourselves, but for the folks that come after us, and to build the kind of world that we want to show up into. So until next time, let's continue to keep trying to do a little bit better together.